Hello.
Good evening, George.
Hi, Victor. How are you?
I'm very well. Yourself?
Good. Fine.
Very good. All ready for the holidays?
Oh, yeah, the holidays. They come faster now each year. Somehow somebody seems to steal a month.
I know the feeling.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's get started.
Okay.
So welcome, everyone. Welcome to our monthly mastermind with Mr. George Ross. George has been in business for over 60 years. He taught at the law school at NYU for over 20 years, the author of two best-selling books on real estate and negotiation, married for 66 years, and worked in the Trump Organization for many years, co-star of the TV show The Apprentice. So we're super fortunate to have access to his wisdom and experience. So welcome to this month's call, George.
Dave, good to be here again.
So, George, this past week I had quite an interesting conversation. I met with Mitch Garrett, who's currently the VP of Hotel Operations in the Trump Organization. Mm-hmm. And that's a role he's been in since 2015. And we're talking about, you know, what's going on in the news and all of that sort of thing. And his perspective is that so much of what's being reported in the news is just utterly ridiculous.
He's right.
How does this happen? I mean, you know, the media have been so unfair to the Trump family, to the whole Trump Organization. What's your perspective?
The perspective is, as far as the why the media is and the bulk of the media, you have to understand where it comes from. The media, the bulk of the media, I would say, with the exception of Fox News, but the rest of them at that point, they were caught by unawares that Donald became president. They never thought he was going to become president. They had predicted he's going to lose in a tremendous amount. All of the polls indicated he was way down in the polls, and they loved it. That was fine. I mean, he's always been a controversial character, especially how he got nominated, and he was good fodder for him. But then when he got elected, now all of a sudden they were dead wrong. So what are we going to do? So somehow they have to indicate that it was a fluke, or we'll attack him. And attacking Donald Trump is good news. Saying something nice about him is not. So they basically will have a tendency to say something not nice, because that's the way it is. They're not reporting the news as impartial. They always take a stance, and they're certainly anti-Trump. And one of the problems, or not a problem, one of the things is when he's attacked, he fights back, and they don't like somebody who fights back, but it does prolong the battle. And this continues on, and it will be through his presidency. Maybe at some point the media will recognize some of the things he did, but I think more important is the people in the United States will recognize it, and they'll see whether or not he gets reelected.
You know, if you listen to some of the news media, you'd think he's minutes away from being impeached.
Of course. Yeah, but that's, understand, in order to evaluate it, you have to understand the media is, they need audience. And that's, if they get audience, they get sponsors. If they get sponsors, they get money. The only way to get audience at that point is coming up with something scandalous or low down at this point. Nobody likes to hear that somebody is doing a good job. That doesn't bring in the audience. But at this point, give them something negative, and they'll chew on it for a day or 2 days or 3 days or a week or something with the family. They'll take anything at that point as long as it's anti-Trump, which is unfortunate, but that's the way it is.
Indeed. So how do we make sense of what we're hearing?
Does it make sense of what you're hearing? Ignore most of it. In other words, when I say ignore most of it, the Russia thing is a nothing. All right. That's a nothing, except it's highlighted and it's been big publicity. And if they don't come up with something, which they have to come up with at this point, they have spent millions of dollars investigating something. He didn't collude with Russia. Now, there is no such thing as collusion, but he didn't. Did Russia interfere in the election? Yes. Did they interfere in anybody's elections? Yes. Canada, it doesn't make a difference who it is. They're going to interfere by hacking or whatever else it is. And China and others are going to. That's what they're going to do. That's going to be standard practice. But did he do it in connection with Trump? No.
That makes sense. That makes sense.
Yeah, but that's so then you see it. And if you look at everything that has come out of it, you're almost 2 years. What has come out that indicate that he basically was in cahoots with Russia to swing the election or to do the election?
I haven't seen anything, really.
Where? Nothing. There isn't anything. Now, would they have preferred to have him instead of Hillary? Of course. But why is it any different? I mean, I'm sure now if you took votes as to who would like to be other in the UK other than May, you'd find other candidates as well. So it depends on which one that you like. So is this, if there was a choice between it, I think the Russians would have been happier, saying they could deal with Trump easier than they could deal with Hillary. And that was their feeling. So if they had to go one way or another, which they should, and there's nothing wrong with it. I mean, there's nothing wrong with a country or a leader of a country at that point siding with one particular candidate. Nothing wrong with that. If they do something illegal, that's different. But if they just have a tendency to like one better than the other, why not? There's nothing criminal, nothing wrong with it. And nevertheless, if the media thinks that's inappropriate, then it's inappropriate. But that doesn't make it so. So to me, it's much ado about nothing. I mean, there's things there. Yeah, people lied. But if you look at this, the people lied before the grand jury. But where is the actual crime other than they lied or they didn't know certain things or their memory? But where is the physical crime? That doesn't come out. So it's a process crime. Right. So, but nevertheless, the media loves it. And maybe they high up as long as it's somebody that can be connected either remotely or in a different way. The closer you get to Trump, that's good. Then it's good news. And that's what they think. I think that the people in the United States are smarter than that. And that's what happened when that's how Donald got elected. And I think that they see through a lot of this, and they're going to, when they have to make a decision in 2020, they're going to say, hey, what did you do? What did you accomplish? And if the president accomplished something, that's good. That's what they're relying on. If the Congress can't get their act together, and they can't, then basically it's going to fall on their shoulders. I think that the Democrats are going to overplay their hand, and that's unfortunate. I think it'd be nice if we had a government where people could work together instead of attack one another.
It is. You know, one of the things that I've noticed from having met a number of folks within the Trump organization, whether it's yourself, whether it's Mitch, whether it's Donald's son, Eric. I mean, I've really been impressed always with the high caliber of the people. Many of the people that, you know, I've run into have longstanding tenure in their position.
They're smart. This was the organization was very well run, making a pot full of money. It's a top-notch organization. Always has been. They always got good people. They knew what they were doing, and the results are there. But, you know, when it gets to the press or what have you, or they're not business people. So they don't recognize when you have, somebody's doing a great business. But any of his hotels or what have you, they're top-notch. They got good ratings and good, they're run at the top of the mill. And, they're getting good mm-hmm. bidding, good business. They know how to run a hotel or run whatever operation they have, a golf course or what have you. Top-notch people and very, very successful doing that. And, but that was what they did before. That's how he made his money.
You don't build wealth like that by accident. There's no way.
No, not at all. But one of the keys, he always had a very good organization and good people involved with it. And his major attribute, what do I think is his best attribute? He has the ability and the willingness to delegate authority and let the people that he delegates authority run with the ball so that he doesn't have to get directly involved. And you can build a tremendous organization if you've got good people. That's the story with him.
All right. Very good. Well, let's go to Dave Zook. The first two questions are from Dave. Dave, are you there?
All right. There we go. Hi, George.
Hi, Dave. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm superb.
All right. Hey, we've got a situation. It's a large project. We just recently got a term sheet. It's a loan at a 73% loan to cost. It's a little bit unconventional. The interest rate is at a bit of a premium, and it's calculated at LIBOR plus 575, so the total is around 8%. Mm-hmm. The loan's non-recourse, which is one of the reasons why we're going this route. It's a construction deal, but it contains completion guarantees. The completion guarantees requires the GC to post a PMP bond.
What's a PMP bond?
Victor, what is the PMP bond?
So this is it's a
Victor and I are working together on this.
So this is a performance and completion bond.
Okay. So he's going to bond that he's going to complete within as long as he gets the money that he's promised under the construction.
Correct.
Yep. Okay.
So the question is, what are your thoughts on a completion guarantee? And as a deal sponsor like this, are we taking any undue risk? What's your experience there?
When I say deal sponsor at this point, who's the deal sponsor? Who's taking down a loan? What is it? So, a corporation?
So Victor and I and
no, not personally.
Partners.
No, it's there's six. You're taking, there's six sponsors.
No, but this point.
Correct.
Well, but wait, under the state at this point. The party that's taking the loan, I assume, is an entity, a corporation of some sort, an LLC, an LLP. It's not you personally.
Correct.
All right.
An LLC.
All right. So now the question, so you got an LLC at this point that basically is on the hook for the loan. So when you say it's non-recourse, it's recourse as to the entity, but not recourse as to the sponsors.
It's only recourse. Am I right? Only recourse to the sponsors insofar as the completion guarantee.
Understand, and you also have right, but you also have a guarantee. It is what you're getting from the construction.
Correct.
People.
Yes.
So you've got two guarantees in addition, and you also have a performance bond. Which so somebody says they guarantee that the building will be complete as long as the construction as people get their money. So you've got a belt and suspenders. What more do you need?
Yeah. So the next right along with that,
the question is at this point if you stand in line behind everything that you got, are you taking an undue risk? The answer is no.
Okay.
The answer is no. You're not taking an undue risk, and you're not going to be there because you have too many places in front of you.
One of the terms in the loan, it also calls out that if any one of the sponsors commits fraud or declares bankruptcy, and this could
That's
be
ridiculous.
in some other deal, not even related to this.
No,
deal.
It's got nothing. No, that now they're overreaching because they're not relying. They're not relying on the sponsors at that point for financial capability. They're relying upon that the thing gets considered. Their liability is, in fact, if the thing doesn't get built.
So
not
do you
financial,
believe
they're
that
not paying it. I think there's a thing basically overreaching as far as the sponsors are concerned. Or if there were one sponsor, I could understand it. If there's more than one sponsor, then they're overreaching because the fact that one of the sponsors might have a financial problem shouldn't wreck the whole transaction. The other should be responsible for it.
So you think this is thing that we should negotiate out?
Yes, I mean, to an extent.
Okay.
Right. Yeah. In the event, if it's fraud which affects the project, that's different. But if it's just fraud,
yeah.
It doesn't affect the project, then it shouldn't be anything else. If it's just a bad reputation or another project which has nothing to do with this. If it adversely affects the completion of the project or the fact that it will be completed and ultimately sold because there's somewhere there's a takeout, then I can see that. But other than that, it shouldn't be there. Although it's not atypical, it's typical. But it's typical for a single sponsor, not for a combination of sponsors. And certainly, since it's non-recourse. It almost turns out to be they're taking a non-recourse loan and making it recourse.
Well, and that was the concern.
Yeah.
And paying you the rate as if it was a recourse loan.
Okay. Right along with that, on the same project, the second question is that we have received an offer for mezzanine financing. The benefit is that we can leverage an additional portion of the project without having to give up equity. The rate is close to 14%. It would replace about $5 million of the capital stack.
Yeah.
But the project would generate enough of value so that even after the mezzanine is paid off, when the first and second mortgage get converted to permanent financing, the project should be leveraged around 72% loan to value.
Mm-hmm.
What are your thoughts on a mezzanine financing like this?
Well, mezzanine financing, it's another cost. It's a short-term borrowing. It depends on the nature of the project. But it's usually short-term because it's only during the cost of construction. It's not until you ultimately have the takeout. So it's not something that's going to continue for a long period of time. But it's a secondary loan, and as such has a secondary rate. There's nothing wrong with it.
Yep.
Assuming that the results are such that you can build it into your costs. It doesn't kill the deal. It just helps you out that rather than raise the equity, which you don't have the equity, or if you had to borrow, you might have problems with the equity or giving up the equity, which could be worse. Then short-term financing or a bridge loan or mezzanine financing, call it what you like. I've seen it dozens and dozens of times, and it certainly works.
Okay.
Have you ever encountered?
Thank you.
Is the mezzanine financing, one thing is, how about, is the mezzanine financing recourse or non-recourse?
The mezzanine would be recourse. But in that particular instance, it's recourse on $5 million, not recourse on like 30.
Yeah, that's fine. No, that's not unusual. You didn't mention it. Yeah. I just wanted to know one way or the other. Typically, it is recourse because they're taking a secondary risk.
Correct.
So as a result, that's less secure than the one that's got the original construction loan. So I've seen it. There are a lot of companies that do it and get very well paid for it. And it's also a way of raising money in lieu of taking it out of equity or borrowing wherever you have to borrow to get it in the equity. So instead, if you don't have the cash on hand, this is a good way to do it.
George, if you were vetting a mezz player, how do you know that you're working with someone? I mean, yes, obviously they're going to perform and they're going to fund the project. How do you know you're not dealing with someone who's a vulture and who's setting you up to fail?
Well, that's a reputation. I mean, what have they done before? Financial statements that you can get from them to see what their assets were, how they've done this before, and make sure that they're going to pay on time, that they're going to show up when they have to show up. In other words, I don't know how you're going to get the mezzanine loan, but you get it in pieces. So if you get it in pieces, then you want to see that they meet the timetable or give you the pieces. Otherwise, if they're going to give it to you, maybe they have to bank it. In other words, maybe at that point they have to put a certain trust fund, so that you know it's there. It depends on their reputation. Right. Same thing if you're dealing with a bank. It depends on their reputation. Anybody gives you a construction loan, the question is, are they going to perform?
Any other things we should be watching out for with mezzanine financing?
No, not really, except it's a good source of raising capital. Because if you do a project and it works out and the mezzanine financing was fine and they got paid within the rate, they're accustomed to do more of it because they think you know what you're doing. And also at that point, this gives them an opportunity to get a higher rate than they would ordinarily get because if it were a primary loan instead of a secondary loan. So a lot of companies that do this, and they do it very well. And depending upon how much shortfall you have in your first mortgage or your construction loan, mezzanine financing becomes critical, becomes important. Because otherwise you could have a big gap between the construction financing and the actual cost of construction.
That makes sense. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks, George.
Yep.
Okay, next we have Patrick and Matthew. Yes, they're
very quiet. Let's
see if they're on the line. Patrick, are you on the line?
Sorry, guys. I was trying to unmute and it wasn't working.
All right, perfect. Thanks, Matt. Go ahead.
Good evening, George. How are you?
I'm fine, Matt. How are you?
Okay. So tonight, George, our question is about bringing a new product to a niche market. My partners and I are working to bring a development project to a market that has never seen one of this magnitude. The setting is a small mountain village that has approximately 2.5 million tourists per year. The population demographic is educated, upper, mid to high income, health, wealth, and environmentally conscious type of hipster. Our project is a 100,000 square foot mixed commercial building. It's going to be three stories. The top two are residential condo type, totaling 54 units. The ground floor will be an inside market designed to attract tourism as well as a supply the local population. The question is, how do we bring the largest building ever conceived in this little village to fruition and keep council and locals on our side? In your experience, have you ever encountered the dilemma, and how did you...
The answer is yes, but you got a couple questions. What's an inside market? What do you mean by that?
So it'd be like a farmer's market, sort of niche products, butcher, cheese, soaps, local
George, products. Think of the Chelsea market in New York.
No, I understand. Okay. I hear you at that point. So you're talking back basically that it is a market, but it would be primarily, I would assume, for tourists, because you don't have that many people there on a full-time basis.
Exactly.
You say you got 2.5 million tourists. How many are people that live there?
There'll be about 5,000 in the next year.
Okay, so you got so it's a tourist attraction.
It is.
Okay. It's a tourist attraction. And if it's a tourist attraction, how are you going to sell the condo units?
Condo units will actually be rented as a hotel. We're going to make them either Airbnb.
No, you're not selling them. You're renting them.
We are. We're renting them.
So then they're not condo units.
They'll be condo style. So they'll be full operational apartment style hotel rooms.
Okay. I hear you.
So it'll have the 3 bedrooms, kitchen, bathrooms, that stuff.
Okay. Okay. I hear all of that. And the next step is how do you get the town or the village to go along with this concept?
That is it. They seem to like it so far, as we spoke to a couple of councilors and the planning committee. They understand enough that how they need to keep people in the town as opposed to just coming and going quickly.
Yep.
The more time they spend, the more money they'll spend.
Yeah, I understand that. Well, I don't know what you've figured out as far as your rate of return and the projection, but this is a high risk project because you're dealing in a tourist situation.
Okay.
And how long is the when you say there are how many tourists there are, or you say about 2.5 million a year. How long has this been going on? What's the attraction for the tourists?
The attraction of the tourists is it's located in a little area that has ski hills, art, farmers markets. It's a midpoint for travel to different parts of that province.
Mm-hmm.
As well as the niche type of people that actually come. It's located also 20 minutes from our capital. So it's not far for city people to be able to travel to.
Mm-hmm. How long has it been getting this 2.5 million for tourists?
It's been increasing between 7% and 10% for the last 15 years, roughly, depending. There's been a few down cycles where it's increased smaller amounts. But
how are the tourists handled now?
How are they handled?
Yeah, I mean, where do they stay? Do they have hotels?
Nowhere.
Condo units that are built, houses that they vacation houses, and where are they put up now?
They don't. That's the problem.
Mm-hmm.
There are a few cottages, but not enough to supply and demand.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I hear you.
So you think there's a way to make this happen, or is it just a risk?
I think it's a risk. The way to happen, it's a big gamble.
Okay.
It's a gamble as to the continuation of the tourists or the visitors, whether or not they're going to come into that and stay in that particular area. And what you've got basically is recreation, but there are lots of places that have recreation. And you're dependent that if you're relying on the fact that they're skiing in the area, maybe skiing goes down in popularity, which it has. So it's any type of a vacation situation has got problems, potential problems, but it also has the reward.
Okay. Now, the reason it makes it, we feel like it's less risky, is the fact that it is actually 20 minutes from our capital. So it is a close, it also has the largest Scandinavian spa in North America, which is also continuing to grow substantially.
So those are good pluses.
Yeah.
Those are good pluses, and that's the thing that makes it. But it's the end result is you pay your money, takes your choice. I think it's risky, but it also could have a big reward.
So that's where plan B comes in, with the actual having them, the units as condo units, because we can sell off the condos if need be to subsidize and more.
Well, not sell out the condos. Who's going to buy the condos?
There's a lot of people who want to live there who can't afford to. The average home price there is unaffordable for our local market.
But you're talking about the people that are going to want to live in the village.
Yeah, there's not enough.
These are year rounders.
These are year rounders, yes.
Not the visitors.
Not the visitors. Mm-hmm. If that's the case, if the tourism drops, there's people looking to live in this town because it is that type of a niche type of town.
No, for that's a good safety. It's good safety, though.
Good. Good. Have you good encountered safety. This kind of an issue before in your experience in the past?
Sure.
How did you guys handle it?
Well, I handled it at this point. On the ones that where they took the risk, if it turned out fine, you're a hero. If it does turn out bad, you're not. It's a gamble. Because of the nature of it, primarily this is because it's a tourist or a niche market. As long as the market is there and the product is there, it's fine. But if people change, it's a difference. It could be very hazardous. I mean, you got examples all over the place at this point. You know, like take Las Vegas.
Mm-hmm.
Las Vegas is a niche market, but boy, you could buy people who went over there lost their shirt at a certain period of time because nobody went there.
Yep.
So they got all these buildings, and you could buy them at relatively cheap. Another one you could take in New York, in the city in the United States, with Miami. Definitely a vacation market at that point, overbuilt, and the people didn't come down for second homes. The concept of having a second home more or less disappeared for a while. So they suffered. So that's the nature of that business. It's not like building a residential building in an area at that point where you're always going to have somebody that lives there.
Yep. So you say like a good plan C would be to keep our eyes open to watch how the market grows and if things start to shift to move.
Yeah,
before.
And if you can figure out how to build it in stages as it's necessary, that's great.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So if you can do it and see what it is, what will work on a short term basis, and you don't know.
No.
For example. You know, years ago or not that long, every big development had to have golf courses. Now golf is on a downtrend. People don't want to spend that kind of money, and they don't. So therefore, having a golf facility is not a major attraction. So because times have changed. So this is a similar situation that you have there, is whether or not the fact that the tourism is going to continue. However, having said that, there are areas which have done well and continue to do well. Certainly in Colorado, with a lot of the ski resorts, have done extremely well and continue to do well. But having said that, most of the people that are there are not visitors. They own houses there.
Well, that's what we've seen as an increase in population growth that way substantially as well, with a new modern thinking council. And before, the town that would build 30 homes is now building well over 1,000 within the next year.
Great.
So there is a bit of growth coming that way. And because, again,
that's it. Assuming they have the sales there, that's basically going to make it, the more activity you have, the better it's going to be for your facility. You need people. So what can I tell you? It has a lot of pluses and has a lot of substantial minuses. You got to keep your eye on it and decide whether or not this is a route that you want to go.
Understood. I appreciate it. That's a great answer. I didn't think of it in that form, and it's really a good thing to think about. I appreciate it.
Okay. Good luck.
Thanks, George. I'll let you know how it goes.
Okay. Be interested.
Talk soon.
Okay. So next.
What?
Next is a question that actually independently came in from two separate individuals, both Ed and Joel. And both of them work for Wall Street firms. They earn quite well, selling paper assets to investors, to Wall Street clients. However, both of them, independently for their own account, choose to invest in real estate. And they're both experiencing a bit of an ethical conflict, doing their job, for which they make very good money, and their own investment strategy what's fundamentally in disagreement with what they're selling. So I think both of them are trying to figure out how they navigate a path to living and working where there isn't that gap between what they're saying and what they're doing. Any thoughts on how they...
Well, not what they're saying or what they're doing. You're talking about two different products. And the products don't mix. In other words, in Wall Street, or the investments that you have in the investment strategy and companies or growth or what have, is a world unto itself. And it's basically talking about value, talking about stock price, talking about what happens in the future. And it depends on a number of factors, but it's not factors which can be controlled. It's controlled by the marketplace, or it's controlled by many facilities, or many things that happen that you have no control over, such as the economy, how it's viewed, whether or not that interest rates go up, whereas real estate is a different world. It's not the same. But real estate has one big advantage. It's always there. It doesn't move. So it has value and will continue to have value, and it will run in cycles, but it never really gets wiped out. It could go do a down in value, but over a period of time, traditionally, it's gotten higher value because it always takes into account inflation automatically. So it's a different animal. They're not inconsistent. They're just two separate products. One is sold on as far as the stock market are concerned, so is sold on promise, future, or what have you. Some products, of course, are sold on return, but even then on the return, you had the return over a period of time based on the track record of the company that's giving you the return. Real estate is a different world. It's based on what you can do with the real estate and how much income you could get, or kind of what utilization you could have over a short period of time. And over a long period of time, you can be fairly certain that if you put it in the right place and it's not movable, then at that it can turn out to be something very successful. If you pick the right spot, you're going to be very successful. If you pick the wrong spot, you're not. But it's not like we have more control over it than you do on the paper assets, as you mm-hmm. call them, which you have no control over. So it's not an ethical question. They're selling two different products.
So there really is no conflict.
There's no conflict. It's not an ethical conflict. You're not selling. You're promoting something that you think is good, but you have no control over. But you've done the research and you think it's a good investment. So I'll invest in General Motors, or I'll invest in this industry. I'll invest in a high tech or a new company starting high tech because I think it will go good and I got a chance to make a real, real killing. So I'm not looking to say I'll make 10% or 15% on my money, but I'll make 100% over a period of 3 years, or 300%. It's got a greater potential, but also the greater risk because it may not happen. Real estate doesn't usually have that risk, but it also doesn't have the return. So it's we're talking two different products, but they're not inconsistent. They're just two separate products.
That makes a lot of sense. That makes a lot of sense.
And you find the same thing. No, you find the same thing in what you call the paper asset on Wall Street. They sell stocks and they sell bonds. The stocks have an equity position. The bonds don't, although some of them are convertible and could be, but they don't. But meanwhile, it's a fixed return so that you know the company is going to pay it. And very often the bonds are guaranteed somewhere. Some entity guarantees them. So you're making a loan, which is relatively secured. When you buy a stock, you're not making a loan. It's not secured. So it's a different animal, but it's done differently. That's not like real estate. Real estate, you can point to it and say, this is mine. And if it's good, fine. If it's not, that's my problem. But generally speaking, it has a more stability than anything in the stock market. But they're not inconsistent. And there's not saying, how can I sell one and yet buy another? If they want something that's going to grow, real estate is, to me, the answer. If you want something that's risky, invest in the stock market. However, having said that, if you're smart, you'll diversify and have something in both.
No, I like that answer. That When the question came in, I thought it was a great question, and I still think it's a great question, but I love your answer.
Yeah. Oh,
I like it.
Yeah.
Okay. Very good.
You know, so you got, let me just personally at this point, as a, when practicing law at that point, yeah, if you're a good lawyer, you're going to make a lot of money. Question is, what are you going to do with the money if you got it? If you want to build on it, you're going to have to invest it. Where do you want to invest it? And you have to decide. Well, when you invest at this point, you have to figure out, do I want something with a lot of risk, or do I want something with not much risk, or do I want solid what I want? And you can split it up. It doesn't have to be all or nothing. So now but you have a financial planner, which I have, and I highly recommend that anybody that has a substantial amount of money or planning, if you just have a financial planner and said, okay, here, what do you want? Are you looking for long-term? You're looking for short-term growth, a lot of income. You're looking for long-term growth. What are you looking for, and what are you figuring for the future? How much money do you want or interest? And then they can just split it up, 10% here, 20% there. So you now have covered a marketplace with dollars that makes the most amount of sense. Part of it could be real estate. And what I did personally was I took, so knowing, having been involved in real estate, I took a lot of the money that I was making in the law firm, and I invested it in real estate. I invested it in with entities that knew what they were doing in real estate. And I knew that because I was their lawyer. And they were building, they were involved with residential construction in the city of Manhattan. And I said, good, I'd like to be part of your entity. I'll put up my share of the money. You won't hear from me. If you have a capital call, I'm there. And I'm now just an equity investor. And I had faith because I saw what they did, and I liked it. I didn't want the control because these guys are good, and I had full faith. And it turned out to be extremely successful over 3 years because real estate has appreciated in value. They knew what they were doing. It was mostly residential structures. Everybody has to live. Manhattan got very hot. And as a result, these investments, as small as they are, like 2% of this company and 3% of that company, turned out to be worth a lot of dollars. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that was my feeling. Did I take flyers? Yes, at a time. But I never took one that was going to break the bank. So it's a question of balance.
I love it. Okay, let's go to the next question. Next question is from Tammy Mitchell. Tammy, you're on the line.
How you doing, George?
I'm doing good, Tammy. How are you doing?
Great, great. I love all the wisdom. I was just writing down a whole bunch of notes. Thank you so much. it's always great to take away some nuggets from you.
Good. Good. It's good to refresh your memory every once in a while. Something will come back and you say, let me look at my notes. And you'll find out it means more meaningful at a later point in time than it was when you heard it the first time.
Definitely. I agree. And I think there's something to be said about writing it down. It just sinks into the brain a little bit more.
For sure.
Well, I have a question I would love your thoughts on. I have the good fortune of getting to network with, communicate, connect with many high net worth individuals. And as you know, many of those people, they're very busy. They're being pulled in multiple directions at all times. And they get very discerning with their time and what they take the time to invest in. I find that when I have the opportunity to speak with them in person at an event on the phone or a dinner or something, they seem genuinely happy to discuss the real estate projects that I'm working on and express interest in potentially getting involved. However, I'm kind of curious what your thoughts might be, something that might be able to help me convert some of these maybe more effectively. I find when I correspond by email that the results are less predictable. And I'm hoping to get some more timely responses and more call to action, and wondered if you had any advice on how to communicate by email in a way that could elicit a response without seeming pushy or, at worst case, manipulative.
Well, you gave me three curveballs in a row.
So sorry.
That's okay. All right. Now, one of the problems you have with the email is it's a lack of a person. There's no personality. Email has no personality. There's no body language. There's no friendliness that's involved. It's just a blanket statement. And people can interpret it any way they want, whatever time they want. And if they're not interested in what the email says at the time, then you've lost them. And that's okay. That's a hazard which you have. Now, if you have something that does have a time element, specific time element, and you want to put the time element on it, then you can contact. That's one way of getting the attention of the recipient of the email, and say, look, I have this following transaction. This is, I give, here are all the terms. Basically, it is selling out. If you want to participate in it, you must notify me within 10 days, 5 days, or what have you. Otherwise, I will assume you're not interested. Now, that will probably elicit a response if they are interested. And if they're not interested, you have no response, which you didn't have anyway if you didn't put a time limit on it. But
good point.
Having said that, the key to making a good relationship is to get involved with the clients, but not on a business relationship. You have to find out what are they interested in. Are they interested in sports? Do they have children? Do they go to? Are they interested in concerts? What do they do? When you set it up that we go to periodically, you'll have meetings or you'll go out to dinner and something that they would be interested in at this. The more contacts you have which are not of a direct business nature, that solidifies them with you. You're more of a friend than you are a party in which you're looking to make an investment.
Sure.
That's the key.
I agree. I think Victor would tell you that's actually something I spend a lot of time and energy on, very intentional about authentically creating some great relationships. And I have a lot of people, when I meet with them, they'll say, hey, yeah, email me something over. But I think you're right about being specific about the timeline and the urgency. Mm-hmm. And like you said, if they're not going to reply anyway, what's the harm in putting some, you know, they either are or they aren't.
He's setting the time element mm-hmm. that you have. Assume now you set a time element at this point and they totally ignored it. All right. Now, the next thing that you have is the next meeting that you have where you talk is say, gee, Joe, I'm very sorry. You didn't know the deal we were talking about. I'm sorry you didn't went into it. It turned out at that point I had a 30% profit in 2 months. I wish you were a part of it. That will get their attention.
No, that's great. That's great. That's great advice, actually.
Yeah. So now if you go back and don't tell them the ones that failed.
What failed, George? Yeah.
But the ones that were successful say, see, gee, I really wish you went into it. You missed an opportunity to do this.
Right.
And here's what happened. So next time it happens, would you like me to contact you if it comes again? They'll say yes.
Great. Yes, I appreciate that. Yeah, because a lot of them will say, be sure you email me, send me some emails on that.
Yeah.
And
yeah, the personal relationship is important, especially, you know, the family, you know, this. And if you keep it on a friendly basis, it works.
Definitely.
I mean,
well,
for example, I'm involved with a lot of charities at this point. And one of the major charities, every time it comes up that I'm about due to make another substantial donation, they take me out to a fantastic dinner and they talk to me and how are the kids. They know my children, the grandchildren, whatever it is. And it becomes like friendly. But meanwhile, I know they're looking for dollars, which is fine. That's what they're doing. And that's good. And the same thing, what you're looking for, an investor. It's basically the same concept, albeit for a slightly different purpose.
All
but the personal relationship is important.
Yeah.
And we've had it. The opposite is also true, is on another charity, which I was very involved with, the person who relates to the woman that was in charge, for some reason, I just didn't continue the personal relationship. And you know what? I stopped giving money to it. If they don't care enough about me to understand personal and to keep in touch, forget it. And there are enough of other places that would be more than happy to take the check. So the opposite did work. And you know what happened? As soon as you stopped giving the donations, they put somebody else on the call and said, "What happened? Why did you stop?" And then you tell them why you stopped. And then at that point, they want to keep the relationship going. So periodically, they keep in touch and tell you what they're doing and whatever is required to keep the relationship alive.
Great. Very good. Thank you, George.
You're welcome.
I love that. That was very good, George.
What's next?
So next we have Todd Salzinger in California. Now, Todd is on the call, but he's actually in a noisy environment, so he asked me to ask the question for him.
Okay.
So his question is that when you've negotiated real estate purchase agreements, what are maybe some examples of two or three contract terms that you like to include that most attorneys wouldn't or would, you know, maybe considered atypical? Do you have some examples, the contract terms that you've used in the past that created a tremendous amount of leverage for your client that are not typical?
Well, not a tremendous amount of leverage. That would say typical. You have to really go into the contract, the nature of the contract, and what's involved in order to come up with a solution. For example, I have put in where I'm selling a piece of property. And we have a contract that's supposed to close in 60 days. And I would put in that if it doesn't close in 60 days and the buyer wants an extension, I'll give him an extension, but I get him more of a deposit. So I'll get an additional deposit for 30 days or whatever. Now, if I put it in the contract and he's never used it, I can get it and go around. Now, if he asks for an extension at this, I'm not giving it free. Say, fine, you agreed to pay another 10%, 20% or what have you as a deposit, but I built it in initially. So it's some type of a penalty, but it's only a penalty if somebody does something wrong or something went out of whack. So when you put it in, it's not meaningful because it's not happening. However, at a later point in time, it stops the argument. So if somebody says, well, I want another 30 days, and I'll say, good, so you got to give me another 15% the deposit on the contract. What do you mean? Why should I give you that? Now you're arguing, whereas if I put it in a contract initially, there'd be no argument.
I like that. So would you?
So you got performance provisions. You got all sorts of things. And the question also of good faith, where I've had in many situations where it's subject to the buyer getting an appropriate mortgage of a certain amount, the bank. Then I want to put in good faith that they will make what they have to do. To applications they have to file on a timely basis with the bank and keep me advised. And I want to know what the bank was, and they have to keep me advised to see that they did what they're supposed to. They have to file financial statements so that they just can't say, I didn't get the loan from the bank, so therefore we don't close. Now I can say, well, wait a minute, just put, did you do everything you were supposed to do? And if I saw they didn't, then that's different. We got a breach. I'm not giving you back your money because you didn't do what you're supposed to do. However, if you did do what you're supposed to, it's fine. So you're keeping them intact and keeping them involved in the contractual arrangement, but you're not penalizing them unless they have done something wrong. And when you ask for it in the first instance, it's something they say, of course I'm going to do. So it's not something that's wrong. You're not posing an objectionable arrangement or something that they can do. All you're doing is saying, I want to make sure you're living up to your end of the bargain.
Wow, those are two amazing nuggets. I mean, I'm blown away. Those are really good.
Yeah. And it's not specific. It could be specific to a given situation. When I say it's a given situation, say, well, if you want a delay on the contract at that point, you got to notify me 10 days or 20 days before the due date. And if you notify me 20 days before the due date, you give me additional deposit. So that may never happen. But meanwhile, it's nice to know, and you put something on the other side. Now, if somebody says, okay, I want to delay the contract, well, wait a minute, you were supposed to tell me that 20 days ago. What happened? And you're immediately putting them on the defensive. So you can put these provisions in, and they're fine because they're meaningless at the time they are made, but they could be meaningful at a later point in time when something came up that was unforeseen.
So if we flip that around, let's say you're on the buyer side and the seller owes you some due diligence, would you say that the seller mm-hmm. has to provide these items in a timely manner?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And in a timely manner. And maybe if you don't provide it in a timely manner, what happens? Some type of a penalty involved. If my mortgage rate went up, you pay the additional mortgage rate. So it could go on either side, depending upon who is injured. The injured party is entitled to some type of a remedy. Doesn't necessarily have to be money, but it could be money. But meanwhile, there's some consideration. But if you put it in the contract initially, it's there, but nobody is charged. It doesn't cost anybody anything at that time. So it's painless to say, oh, I'm not going to do that. I'll act in good faith. On the other hand, if you don't put it in and somebody doesn't act in good faith, now what are you going to do when they don't act in good faith? How are you going to enforce it without creating a brouhaha?
I love that. That changes the way of thinking. Yeah,
it could be either side. Could be either side, depending upon what's important to the buyer, what's important to the seller. For example, as far as the buyer is concerned, and you say the seller has to do due diligence. Hey, if if you've got a mortgage commitment and you paid dollars for that commitment and it's about to expire or it's about to change, you're injured if the seller didn't do what they're supposed to do. So now you can provide that. Hey, if you didn't do what you're supposed to do and I'm injured by, I lost my mortgage or the interest rate went up, you pay the interest rate. Now, if you do that at the time the contract is drawn, there's not a dispute because they're not going to do it. They're not going to, they say, I'm not going to do that. So therefore, you don't have a problem, but you try to get it at a later point in time, and now it becomes a bone of contention because you're asking for something that was not originally part of it. And it's meaningful, but the other side said, no, I didn't do it. Why should I pay for it?
It's a great question and an even better answer.
Well, these contracts, you can do it. The contract's fine. You do it, but the thing is to do it in the contract, in the original contract. When the contract is signed, what's important to if you're on the buyer side, what's important to me is the buyer. If I'm on the seller side, what's important to me on the seller? So if the buyer, if I'm important on the seller, from the seller side, if the buyer's supposed to do something, they don't do it, they get penalized somehow. But that's what the contract says. So if you want another 30 days, here's what happens. You pay more. The price went up. Or you got to pay for the hotel room, I suppose, whatever it is. But you do it in the contract. It works for both sides, depending on which side you're on. What's important, and you tell the other side, good, this is what you say you're going to do. If you don't do it, what happens? Something's got to happen. Nothing horrendous. I'm not talking about a horrendous penalty, but I'm talking about some type of remuneration or to make up for the fact that you have been injured.
That's pure gold, George.
Yep.
Okay, well, we're pretty much at the top of the hour. I don't think a couple of questions we didn't get to, but we'll carry them forward to next month.
Great.
So have a great holiday.
Great holiday. Merry Christmas. And let me know when what's the date in January.
Okay, definitely we'll do that. And if I don't talk to you before your birthday, happy birthday.
Thank you much.
Okay.
Okay.
Have a good night.
Have a good night.
Thanks. All right. Bye for now.